By listening to the Conscious Fertility Podcast, you agree to not use this podcast as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others. Consult your own physician or healthcare provider for any medical issues that you may be having. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast. Welcome to Conscious Fertility, the show that listens to all of your fertility questions so that you can move from fear and suffering to peace of mind and joy. My name is Lauren Brown. I'm a doctor of traditional Chinese medicine and a clinical hypnotherapist. I'm on a mission to explore all the paths to peak fertility and joyful living. It's time to learn how to be and receive so that you can create life on purpose. I want to welcome back Dr. Nikki Kay to the Conscious Fertility Podcast. Now, if you haven't already listened to her original episode with me, it's episode 91. It's called The Female Hormone Odyssey, Perimenopause, Fertility, and Beyond. And again, that's episode 91. Check that out. Nikki, I had such a good time with you. I thought we should continue the conversation.
Yep, absolutely. No, thanks for having me back. Looking forward to it.
So I want to let our listeners know who you are, because some of them may be hearing this for the first time and they'll go listen to episode 91 after. And I'm going to do a very short recap because we're not going to go over everything we went in episode one. That was close to an hour. They can go listen to that, but I'll give them a 2-minute recap. But first, I'd like to just formally introduce our guest today, Dr. Nikki Kay. She is a medical doctor specializing in exercise endocrinology with expertise in hormone health or optimization for athletes, dancers, and individuals experiencing perimenopause and menopause. She integrates her clinical experience and medical research in endocrinology, exercise, and sport medicine to offer personalized approaches to hormone health. Dr. Kay studied medicine at Cambridge University, became a member of the Royal College of Physicians, and contributed to developing an anti-doping test for growth hormones. She holds an honorary clinical lecturer position at the University College of London, where she researches the impacts of lifestyle, nutrition, and exercise on hormone networks. And she is the author of Hormones, Health, and Human Potential, and editor of Myths of Menopause, as well as a regular keynote speaker at international conferences and on podcasts like the Conscious Fertility Podcast. So welcome back, Dr. Nikki.
Thank you.
So this is what we talked about last time, just for our listeners. We talked about just, you use this idea of the female hormone odyssey and that there's an orchestra, and you compared kind of the hormonal orchestra with the pituitary gland acting as the conductor. And sometimes we can get fluctuating symptoms or hormones in that perimenopause period, kind of resembling an orchestra that gets out of tune. As I mentioned to everybody, that's episode 91. I want to start with what the listeners have been asking me when I told them you're coming back on as a guest. They wanted to know about perimenopause and menopause unwanted weight gain. So I want us to talk a lot about that today because of your, in the last episode, and your experience with exercise and how it affects hormones. But first, maybe we should back up. Can you define or tell us what is perimenopause and menopause? Because I think they're being used interchangeably, but they are different.
Absolutely, yeah. So menopause is like the full stop of a sentence, whereas perimenopause is sort of like a comma, if you sort of mean. So menopause is the full stop. It's the point in time when the ovaries retire. So going back to that female hormone odyssey, just to remind everyone, obviously, as a child, as a girl, you're not having periods. The ovaries are asleep, if you will. And then the conductor of the endocrine orchestra gets going. Menarche, that's when the ovaries wake up. You start experiencing periods, menstrual cycles. And this continues up until the ovaries retire at menopause. And now your ovarian hormones, the estrogen and progesterone, go back down to almost childlike levels, very low. So so that's what the definition of menopause is. It translates to, you know, pause or stop of the menses, the period. So it means the time from which you have no further periods. But it's not an on-off switch. That's really the key thing. It's not that one day the ovaries are working and then the next day that's it. They sort of, perimenopause, I describe it as the time when the ovaries are going part-time. You know, there will be some cycles when everything is fine. The orchestra is playing nicely, everything, you know. And then the next cycle, it's a little bit, yeah, out of tune, as you say. The ovaries are a little bit more reluctant. And so this is the perimenopause, by definition, is the time of uncertainty and fluctuation. And that makes it really challenging time because you, wonder, even if you're imagining it. It's like, what's going on here? And it's so variable. So that's really the definition. The perimenopause is the winding down in a slightly erratic way, if I can put it like that, of the ovaries. And menopause is the definite full stop when the ovaries are sort of stopped. And in that sense, once you've reached that point when the ovaries have officially and definitely retired, it kind of makes it a little bit easier to know how where you are in terms of your hormones. So hopefully that clarifies it. So they're very similar sounding terms, obviously, perimenopause, menopause, but you're absolutely right that it's important to distinguish because they are characterized by different hormone signatures, if you will.
And in menopause, the Western medical definition is 1 year after your ovaries retired, 1 year after you no longer menstruate. And so for those women, they can kind of understand some of these vasomotor symptoms like night sweats, hot flashes, disturbed sleep, mood, weight gain, because they see their cycle. For the women, and I think, I don't know what the medical definition is of today. I think it used to be above 45 is perimenopause. Clinically, in my practice, it's 40 and above. And you can see even before 40, but definitely 40 and above. For them, it can be challenging. Like you said, they think they're going crazy because they're still menstruating, but they're having some really unwanted symptoms.
Yeah, I think that's just a few points you've made there just to clarify. So menopause, it's a bit weird. It's what we say a retrospective diagnosis. So say the average age of menopause is 51, but you can only be certain you've reached menopause when you look back and say, oh, that's a whole year now, I haven't had any periods. So now you're 52, you reflect back and say, oh, yes, it's exactly a year ago when I was 51, when I had my last period. So only then can you sort of absolutely say that's menopause. And so officially during that time, that sort of you're in the waiting room, as it were, for that year. You're on tenterhooks because you're still officially in perimenopause because you don't know, you might get another period, which goes back to this crucial thing about it being this time of uncertainty. So that was the first point about menopause, strictly speaking, as a retrospective diagnosis. And then when does, so perimenopause only finishes when you've looked back and said no periods during that year and you go backwards. And when does perimenopause itself start? So when do the ovaries start going part-time? And as you say, that's a very variable feast, as it were. I mean, the age of menopause, average age is 51, with the range being from 45 to 55. So that's menopause, full stop. And they say that perimenopause can start any time, maybe up to 6 years before menopause. But you don't know, you can't foresee when your menopause will be in the future. So I agree with you. I tend to think of it more like 40. So from the time of 40, maybe you're going to have menopause at 45 or 46. So therefore, you will start experiencing ovaries going part-time, hormone fluxes from the age of 40. On the other hand, if you're destined to have a later menopause, say at 55, you might not start noticing symptoms of perimenopause until what's that? Doing the math there, 49. You see what I mean? So we can't say there is a generic time for starting perimenopause because unless we can see in a crystal ball and know when menopause is, we don't really know. But I tend to agree with you, and I've seen even some women of younger in their late 30s who have the odd cycle, which is a bit, I'm not sure about that one. That wasn't quite what we expected. So, it can even start before that. But generally, I agree with you. I think a sort of round about 40, you're going to have a high index of suspicion if the woman's coming saying her cycles have changed. Typically, they become shorter initially, maybe heavier, maybe, like you say, not feeling so good, the occasional hot flush, we call them over here, or whatever. So, things can start kicking off in those early 40s. So this is why perimenopause is such a tricky one because it's so variable.
And that's what I want to talk about, though, is how to help women in that transitional period of their life. And right now, it seems that there is celebrities and celebrity doctors are really pushing hormone replacement therapy, particularly estrogen hormone therapy. And as you're sharing in that perimenopause, let's say 40 and above, there's a huge fluctuation in estrogen. And then when you're in menopause, there is a definite decline in estrogen because you're no longer ovulating. And your progesterone is done as well because you're no longer ovulating. But in the perimenopause phase, you are having a decline in progesterone, just not as much as menopause, because you're ovulating maybe less, or the quality of that follicle that releases the egg isn't as youthful or has that quality like it did in the earlier years. Therefore, your progesterone output is not low. So there's the declining progesterone. But the perimenopause from our last discussion and from your colleague, Dr. Geralyn Pryor, shout out to her. She's episode 89. And again, as I mentioned, Dr. Nikki here is episode 91. She says that estrogen is not necessarily declining in that perimenopause. It's fluctuating and it can go really high. And it's my understanding from the Western paradigm, because we have a whole Chinese medicine paradigm on this as well that we'll geek out about, that a lot of these symptoms of sleep disturbance, heavy bleeding in irregular cycles, and weight gain is related to estrogen fluctuating. So I'm curious, your approach, is estrogen therapy kind of the solution? Because it is being pushed a lot right now. And we're recording this in the spring of 2025. It's being pushed a lot. But if you're already having some high fluctuating levels of estrogen, I'm curious your approach. And then we're going to go into things outside of hormone therapy. But I'm just wanted to ask you about that fluctuating period in those 40s.
Well, listen, I'm a colleague and a great admirer and friend indeed of Geralyn Pryor. So Professor Progesterone, as I call her. Anyway, I mean, yes, just the problem is this. I think that estrogen, everyone has, well, most people have heard of estrogen, but progesterone is always sort of played second fiddle and not been talked about so much. But you're absolutely right. If we look at the nitty gritty of this, of the physiology of these hormone fluxes, the first thing to sort of falter is exactly as you say, it is actually the production of progesterone, because as you say, the you might not ovulate at all, so therefore you're not going to get a corpus luteum, so you're not going to get even get progesterone off the starting block. Or as you say, the follicle maybe isn't, you know, quite up to what it used to be when it was first made, and so the progesterone production will be lower. And this often is the initial explains the initial indication of perimenopause, with the menstrual cycle length actually shortening because of lower levels of product of progesterone. But as you say, in contrast, estrogen is having a whale of time. If not only is it staying at a, you know, a decent level, it might even go spring up quite high. So as you say, it's sort of ruling the roost. And what's the effect of estrogen? It thickens the endometrium. And so this often is why women in perimenopause can not only get short cycles, but very heavy bleeding periods, because there isn't that opposing effect of progesterone. And by the way, it's very interesting, and I probably, no doubt, Professor Pryor mentioned this in her piece, that this is exactly the mirror image of what happens to women, teenagers, when their periods first start. So when their periods first start, there isn't quite that coordination. There isn't quite that slick, you know, the conductor of the pituitary gland hasn't quite got its act together. So often when teenagers start their periods, guess what teenagers complain of often? Very heavy, painful periods, not feeling so good. Why is that? Because estrogen is ruling the roost and progesterone is a little bit not so great yet. And then things settle down. So if we reflect what the teenagers experience, what the perimenopausal women experience, it's actually kind of similar because of the underlying similarity in the physiology. So we definitely need to be talking more about progesterone. So now if we say, okay, so early perimenopause, it's the progesterone that's going low and the estrogen is fine, maybe even high, then does it make any sense to give more estrogen? No. And indeed, officially, HRT or MHT, whatever we want to call it, I prefer HRT because sometimes we do use hormone replacement therapy in women who haven't, not for menopause, actually in young women whose ovaries are insufficient, suffering premature ovarian insufficiency, or in athletes I work with or dancers where their menstrual cycles have stopped because they're under fueling, their bones are suffering. So anyway, HRT, MHT, whatever we're going to call it, it's only officially licensed actually for menopause, right? Not perimenopause. So we've got quite a lot of problems here with doling out HRT, and indeed, certainly you should never give estrogen alone anyway for any woman who's got a uterus, because that would be really dangerous. It's going to thicken that endometrium and potentially increase the risk of endometrial cancer. So we want to do that anyway. So I think we have to be very aware of what's going on and make appropriate choices. So I think that if my approach is, if a woman comes to me and she's in perimenopause, she's really, you know, struggling with really challenging symptoms that are impacting her quality of life, the hot flushes, the poor sleep, all this sort of thing, I would love to do what Geraldine did in her great study in Canada, which is to give micronized progesterone first line, because that will definitely help sleep and the hot flushes and everything. Although sometimes it can be a bit tricky because it's so traditional to give both of them together, the estrogen and the progesterone. So I get around that by giving the lowest possible, just a smidgen of estrogen, just to smooth it out, really. Okay. And then frankly, it's the micronized progesterone that's going to have the benefit there, you know. And so it is something that I would suggest to a woman struggling during perimenopause, but with that proviso, we make the estrogen as low as possible just to smooth things out. But definitely, ideally, the micronized progesterone is really going to help. And sure, once she's then gone through and now is menopausal and the estrogen definitely is low, then we can maybe slightly increase the dose of estrogen. So that's my approach. And hopefully, well, I know that will reinforce, hopefully, what Geraldine has discussed with you about the importance of progesterone. There are two hormones from the ovaries, not just one.
We're very similar than our clinic, who also follows the research of Dr. Geraldine Pryor, do the bioidentical progesterone, and for sure in those women who are still cycling in the 40s, and then low dose estrogen. That study, as you mentioned, because we've got to give a shout out because I'm local Canadian, that's a Canadian study. And when I was in contact with Dr. Pryor just recently, it's evidence-based research showing that progesterone, so these oral progesterone, micronized progesterone, effectively treats perimenopausal night sweats and sleep problems. So that's data coming out of Canada. That's not just anecdotal. That's published
No,
research
it's hard fact,
2023.
and it's a lovely hormone. It
Yeah.
truly does. Speaking from experience, you take it last thing at night. That's really important because it will make you feel a little bit dozy. Well, which is good. So don't
Yeah.
take it in the morning is number one, and it really does do the trick because it helps with sleep, and also because it's helping also with the hot flushes. Then you're not going to have disturbed sleep because of the hot flushes as well. So it's a really brilliant hormone. And the micronized progesterone you mentioned, just to emphasize, that is molecularly identical to what you produce yourself. So this is totally different to the synthetic types of progestogens or progestins, whatever you want to call them. This is the real stuff, if I can put it like that.
Well, now let's talk about some of the symptoms. And as we shared in this perimenopausal phase, there's changing in cycles. So you can have lots of shorts, like lots of cycles in a month versus every 28 days. You can get very heavy bleeding. And then the common questions we had are about unwanted weight gain and sleep issues. So firstly, what's causing the unwanted weight gain and sleep issues? What is the hormonal, what's happening in the orchestra that you've talked about in the past that can lead to this? And feel free to touch on, like, because people are getting aches and pains, people are having
Oh,
brain
yes.
fog. So what is going on that all of a sudden it feels like you've gone crazy?
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, quite. What can I say? I describe these symptoms as like it's like Pandora's box. There is a lot. But fundamentally, what is happening is the hormones are in a state of flux. And so the body is confused, if I can put it like that. The 75% of women, the most common symptom are those vasomotor symptoms, the hot flushes. And that's because the temperature control system, located centrally in the brain, it now really narrows what we call its thermoneutral zone. So if you just go a little bit outside of what it absolutely wants your body temperature to be, it effectively gets in a panic and starts causing you to have sweating and vasodilation. So you get hot and sweaty as though you're in a sauna, even though you're not, but the body kind of thinks you are. And this is really interesting because these hot flushes, obviously they're really annoying because if they happen during the day, inevitably during a podcast or an important meeting or something, it's like, oh, not now. Anyway, but it's totally you can't control. And the other thing is, if they occur when you're trying to sleep, this is going to disturb your sleep. So that compounds to the problem with the sleep patterns, which are also disrupted because of the change in the estrogen and the progesterone balance, if I can put it that way. But the really interesting thing, you mentioned brain fog, it's thought that these hot flushes are linked maybe to, problems with brain fog or cognitive impairment, whatever you want to call it, because during a hot flush, all the blood goes to the skin. That's why you get hot and sweaty. But actually, during that time, there's restricted blood flow to the brain. So that's why you don't feel so good. And also, by the way, it's just horrible because this affects your mood. You have anxiety and things like this, So that's all the sort of that piece of it, if I can put it that way. But coming round to other symptoms, the body composition changes and weight gain, that's a really tricky one. Why is this happening? Because of these hormone fluxes. And also, not only women, we have it a bit tough. Not only are we having these big changes in the ovarian hormones, but also something we share with men, because by the way, men get old as well. In both men and women, an important anabolic hormone called growth hormone decreases. By the way, growth hormone isn't just about children growing. We also produce some as adults, and this hormone is very important for maintaining a favorable body composition, i.e., muscle mass versus deposition of fat, especially visceral fat around the organs. That's not healthy. Growth hormone is really important for that. But as you're getting older, for a woman, you've got the fluxes of the female hormones, which in turn can potentially influence your sensitivity to insulin. Insulin, I think everyone has sort of heard of insulin resistance. So we got that going on with the female hormones. And we've also got on the backdrop of the growth hormone decreasing, which also, as you know, tends to favor the deposition of fat over muscle. So this is this combination, this storm of all these hormones changing during this time. That is why you can notice, the scales, there's a bigger number on the scales now, and also that you notice, especially around the midriff, things are a bit tighter around the waist area because that's where the visceral fat will be deposited. So these are things that you might start to notice. We're going to come onto it, no doubt, what to do about it. But also other things just to mention, typical symptoms. I think you mentioned aches and pains. So sort of really kind of like random aches and pains, not necessarily related to an injury, but you think, oh, have I injured something? But actually, it's just that's what's happened because the estrogen is going up and down. What else can you experience? Actually, digestive issues, because estrogen is very important for the estrobilome, the microbiome specifically dealing with recycling of estrogen. So you can get sort of digestive issues, things like this. Urinary tract issues, needing going to the toilet more, and vaginal dryness. Those tend to happen a little bit further away as you're going into menopause, official menopause. But still, these are all things combined. What else is the headaches? Because maybe the cerebral blood flow, like I mentioned, have been disrupted. Sometimes palpitations, although I would always preface that by saying if you are having palpitations, you definitely need to make sure it's not your heart or it's just a temporary effect of the hormones changing. So there is a whole myriad of symptoms, potential symptoms, but I think this is why it's also really a challenging and confusing time for women because you literally wonder from one day to the next, you think you're falling apart, all these various symptoms, or there will be some women who don't seem to get so many, and some who seem to get a lot. And some women feel that they have to qualify to say, oh, I've got perimenopause to have this full house. So, just to emphasize, you don't have to have a full house of all these symptoms I've mentioned. And it will be, individual and personal to you, which ones are more troublesome than others. So, that's why it's really tough.
And now I want to talk about kind of our approach because you would think that, okay, I'm gaining weight here. I don't want this weight gain. Logically, you say, I'm just going to have to exercise more and eat less. But in our last episode, I got introduced to a term by you, low energy availability, LEA. And you shared how under eating, especially restricting carbohydrates, negatively impacts hormone production. And we're looking to balance that hormone production. And you shared also, you work with athletes, you are a dancer yourself. So can you share with what's going on and explain? Because there's women that are saying, okay, I'm eating less and better, and I'm exercising more, and I'm still not losing weight. So what's going on? And then how do you address that? Then now I kind of want to know your approach. Oh, quick tangent, Chinese medicine paradigm, this fluctuating estrogen, we call it kind of a liver qi stagnation, a liver mechanism, nothing to do with the Western liver. And so if people have had a lot of PMS and really difficult, painful PMS periods, that's a mechanism in the liver qi system. And we would expect that they would probably have a more challenging transition into menopause. And we have herbal formula acupuncture approach to help regulate cycles and also help relieve those symptoms in perimenopause. So that fluctuating thing is observed in the Western medicine, or can be measured. Chinese medicine kind of had an understanding of what's happening to these systems where one becomes deficient, like you say, in menopause. But before, when that system is retiring, if the system that regulates it isn't healthy, then it's chaotic, which is why some women have bad perimenopause and some sail right through it. So that was my quick tangent. I forgot to mention that. But
oh no, well actually, let's just quickly go on that before we get into the lifestyle approach. So that's really interesting that the PMS symptoms can often get worse in perimenopause because, like you say, the hormones are a little bit out of sync. By the way, remembering back to the teenagers, often that's the case. So that all sort of fits with them being out of whack. So that's another sort of thing to put on the list that you might notice. But some women, and we mentioned this just now, some women might experience pretty bad perimenopausal symptoms, and others, still some, but not quite so bad. So why is that? What's the difference between these women? You're right. I really love that point that there is actually, well, I was going to say an official study, but a Western study, if you see what I mean, based, which talks about this triad. So if you're a woman that during your, before you reach perimenopause, you have experienced PMS, maybe you've suffered with postnatal blues or postnatal depression even, it means this is indicating, I'm afraid, that you might be in for a rough ride when it comes to perimenopause, because it just indicates that your personal system, you're very sensitive, your biological response to these hormones and, as you say, crucially, the changes in these hormones. So that's really interesting what you say about the Chinese, of course, are onto it already. Anyway, so that's the PMS story and the sensitivity to your own hormones. So going back to the sort of the lifestyle factors, and there you are. And by the way, I've been here, been there, done that. So I totally understand how people feel. You're in your 40s. You're suspicious that you are maybe going through menopause because of some of the things we've discussed, the more worse PMS, shorter cycles, whatever, maybe a little bit of the hot flushes, some things like this. And you've noticed this annoying change, shift on the scale and shift in your trousers are tighter and things like this. And you really don't like it. So your reflex reaction, quite understandably, might be, oh, so I should eat less and move more and burn up excess energy, and then that will help. And then you get really frustrated and upset because you do that purposefully and it doesn't work. Or worst case scenario, it even makes things worse. So what the heck's going on? And so this is because, like you say, you could fall into the trap of ending up in low energy availability. So absolutely, you probably need to be more mindful. So let's focus on nutrition. So what do we need to do there or consider there? So absolutely, you should, of course, be mindful that you're not eating surplus, because that's not going to be helpful for your hormones. But equally, if you under eat, then that's also going to have a negative effect on your struggling hormones, which actually need some help. So my top tip in terms of nutrition is, please don't do anything crazy. No crash diets, no skipping meals, no, I lose track of the latest things, is it intermittent fasted? I don't know what all these things. It's like, look, just keep it really simple. I suggest stick to your three regular meals a day. Please do break your fast in the morning with breakfast, and please do increase your protein, the portion size of your protein intake. So that's what you do. So you keep everything, it's all about keeping the fundamentals there in place, but changing the proportion. So you have your three regular meals, increasing the protein, the portion size of protein at each, because you need to give those sort of slightly flagging anabolic hormones a helping hand, but also the carbohydrates. Don't complex carbohydrates, I'm talking about cereals, bread, pasta, rice, all those things, which people often associate with all putting on weight. You do still need some of those. But the portion size I do, that will vary. If, for example, today I did a swim. So for my breakfast, I had a really good portion of cereal before I did that. But on a day when maybe I'm not going to be exercising in the morning, maybe it's going to be slightly less a cereal, but it will still be the same amount of milk, still be the same amount of protein. You see what I mean? So you can be flexible with your carbohydrate, but never, I've seen it time and time again, like you describe. And I totally understand it. And I totally appreciate the intention behind it, to restrict what you're eating, to restrict the carbs. And now you're going to try and exercise and you haven't got enough energy. You're not going to do effective exercise. So you're not going to get even the benefit from the exercise you're doing, because you haven't got the energy to, get the benefits from it. So that's the nutrition piece. But as I mentioned here, it's in combination with the exercise piece. So again, the tendency is I've got to do lots of cardiovascular exercise to burn these excess calories, and people go, on the treadmill or long runs or all this sort of thing. Absolutely, you should of course still do some cardiovascular exercise, but just as with the nutrition, you're shifting your focus to the protein. With the exercise, you're shifting your focus to the strength work. Okay, so why? So strength work is brilliant, is the most effective anabolic stimulus there is, because when you do strength work, you're engaging all the muscles in your body generally, and muscles are really suck up the energy, right? So that's great, they're going to use them up. And also, by doing the exercise fueled appropriately, you're going to get the benefits, because now the muscles are going to increase, right? Hypertrophy of these muscles. So now you've already improved your body composition by doing this, encouraging muscle over fat. And also, the muscles are very metabolically active. So now your metabolic rate is raised not only while you're doing the exercise, but also for some time afterwards. So that, I suggest, is the approach, that people don't chuck out all the things. They have those fundamentals at their disposal of the nutrition, the exercise, and the sleep, the recovery. But it's just within each of those, you've got to just change it, the proportions or the emphasis. Just as your hormones are changing, you have to respect that the hormones are changing, and you have to change what you do to give them, give them the support they're looking for.
Thank you for that. And so what's other things that you'd like to do? So we got weight training, you talked about diet, and then do you use progesterone therapy for these women in their perimenopause phase? And do you have supplements? Because they love that. People love to know, is there a few supplements you recommend I can take that can help regulate my blood sugars or help with my hormonal balance? Or maybe it's so individualized you don't have something to suggest, but I'm curious if you have a few of your faves.
Yeah, sure. Well, definitely my approach is always all these lifestyle things we discussed. And then on top of that, sure, then we're maybe going to discuss HRT, if that's all sort of dealt with the emphasis on the progesterone element, of course. But in terms of supplements, I mean, it will depend, but my go-to, which is sort of absolutely for everybody, by the way, of any age, is vitamin D. Because although I commented before we started, oh, got some sunshine in the UK, which is a rare event, I can tell you. Nevertheless, the source of vitamin D, the main source is the action of sunlight on your skin. And certainly in the UK, even if you wander around naked all winter, you're not going to get enough sun on your skin to produce vitamin D. So you absolutely have to supplement at the bare minimum over the winter months. I mean, personally, I take it throughout the year. So that, and why is vitamin D? Why vitamin D? Well-being. But also for bone health, muscle recovery, and immunity. So it's going, and it sought to work in synergy with the sex steroid hormones, so the estradiol and the progesterone. So vitamin D, I think, is an absolute go-to must. Other things I think can be helpful. There is some evidence now coming out about creatine for muscles and brain function. So that's a possibility. If you are a vegetarian, B12, vitamin B12 is a must go to. Other things that have been mentioned or I find sometimes useful, magnesium. I use magnesium spray because I try to not load the gut too much. Because that's the thing, I find so many women or people in general, they come with a whole shopping bag of supplements. And it's like, number one, how much did that cost? And number two, is it actually doing you any good? And it's really confusing. And lots of them are oral, so it's loading a lot of, load for the gut. So when it comes to magnesium, I think the spray version, it's well absorbed through the skin, and it can also help sleep. I spray it on my calf muscles before I go to sleep, have my little routine, take my progesterone, spray my calf muscles with magnesium. You can even get it infused with lavender, and apparently it's meant to help. So I think that would, it's not an essential one, but I think it would be a recommendation. And then depending on your diets, omega-3 maybe. I mean, personally, I eat quite a lot of oily fish, so that's another one. I mean, there's lots of other, so many we could go on and make a whole
Well,
list of other things.
vitamin D, got it. Love that. Creatine, interesting. That's what my teenage boys used to take to bulk up.
Yes, exactly.
B12, you mentioned vegetarian, so I want to go back to that in a minute.
Yeah.
Magnesium, also another staple. The adrenals love it. As you said, sleep, calm that anxiety,
Yeah.
for aches and pains. It is just
Oh,
one of
it's
those
great, isn't it?
staples. I often like my inositol as well because of
Oh,
its
yeah.
blood sugar regulation. Do you like that one as well?
Yes, so that I think if the person really does have a problem with a blood sugar, exactly, that one is very helpful, and you don't need a prescription, and it's a lot, frankly, milder than something like metformin, which is
Right.
hell for the gut, you know. Although sometimes you do have to use if the person is like officially a type 2 diabetic, you know. But yeah, minocetol, I think it wouldn't be like the top one. You'd work through your way through all the others. But then if there was a particular individual, actually, I was concerned about blood sugar regulation, despite doing all the lifestyle things with the exercise, the nutrition, and all everything that we've discussed, then sure, I think that's that. Then that's got evidence that that is helpful. Yes.
So, and again, talk to your doctor, your Chinese medicine doctor, your naturopathic doctor to get a supplement dosage and right for you. What about you talked about the diet and increasing your protein,
Yes.
but then you said complex carbs, be careful of the simple carbs. What about vegetarians? Because protein, a lot of it, there are vegetarian proteins, so but protein's easy for somebody who is not a vegetarian to eat beef, for example. But how do you help or can you advise around vegetarians, because a lot of vegetarians are eating a lot of carbs that are not what you would call your complex carbs as well.
Yes, well, they will be eating. I mean, it depends. Lots of those ones are, although we say, oh, they've got vegetables, got complex carbs in, actually, lots, they're not very digestible. Lots of them have fiber in. So it's not so much the carb load I'm worried about. I mean, facts are facts. It is harder and more challenging, although not totally impossible, to, you know, get increase your protein intake using, vegetable sources. But you know, it really depends. You have to be really mindful of it and target and make sure you're hitting it. And if you can eat fish, for example, some vegetarians are okay to eat a bit of fish or eggs or other things to get that protein, because otherwise it's just quite of a challenge in terms of volume. So, you know, it's possible.
Sometimes in our practice, my focus in my early years of my practice has been reproductive health, fertility. And we do so much around perimenopause and menopause. And I'm often asked, how can you do both, right? Well, and I'm like, from a Chinese medicine perspective, it's the same. Like we're balancing hormones, we're improving ovarian
Same
health and
principles,
adrenal,
same
right?
principles.
Same principles. One wants to have a baby, but they both have irregular bleeding, disturbed sleep, night sweats. So
Good
one is
point.
happy when the symptoms are gone, and the other one's only happy when they have the baby. But the treatment is very similar or the same. So with women that are vegetarian that we see in Chinese medicine, shui deficiency, a blood deficiency, it's not quite what we call anemia in the West, but often we'll check in if they can eat meat and treat it like a medicinal. Like, so I under like for a short period of time, can we treat it like a medicinal? And if not, then we find other ways. And then in Chinese medicine, gynecology, so irregular cycles or cycle issues, fertility, and this perimenopausal symptoms that people experience, herbal is a big part of it. And I mentioned that liver system, again, not your Western liver, it's just how it translates into English. It's responsible for the shift from follicular to ovatory. So, and it's also responsible from the shift from luteal to the next period. And so that's in a micro cycle. And then in the macro cycle, from it's the shift into pu puberty, it helps, right? And then into menopause. So that's why we
It
wanted.
covers those two ends.
So that's why the acupuncture herbal approach is something that I will invite our listeners to check out locally. If your acupuncturist also does herbal medicine, it's something that may help you during this time of transition, whether you're trying to conceive or not, or whether you're experiencing these symptoms.
Absolutely.
And then we talked about supplements, and we talked about diet, and we talked about exercise, and you talked about progesterone, bioidentical progesterone.
I would actually like to ask you a question. Being a medical doctor, I'm very familiar with the lifestyle, with HRT, with some specific supplements like we mentioned, the vitamin D, etc. You know, from my reading and understanding, I think there are probably some herbal supplements that can be beneficial for the individual woman. I just want to ask you your experience. What do you find works? What doesn't work?
Well, there's a modern formula called, from my colleagues, Erxiantan, which is menopause high blood pressure syndrome, is what it's mainly used for. And there's multiple formulas. So there is no, hey, what's an herbal formula for night sweats or perimenopause? Chinese medicine is always individualized in taking the individual and finding their disharmony and treating that, because both could have the same, you could have the same symptom, both could have hot flashes, but they're underlying imbalance is very different. So get treated differently. For example, both have hot flashes, but one's hot when they're not having hot flashes, one's cold. One has constipation, one has diarrhea. One is thin, thin, thin. The other one's overweight. One has really dry skin and brittle nails. One has strong nails and glowing skin. One sleeps like a baby. One has insomnia. So you start to see they would not get the same formula for hot flashes. And then there could be people that have very different symptoms, but their pattern, their underlying imbalance is the same. It's just based on their makeup that it shows up differently on their body. So one could have urinary incontinence. One could have insomnia. So different person. One could have brain fog. And they all have different symptoms, but their patterns are the same. So the formula would be very similar. So you'd get like a key formula and then you'd modify it. Now, myself in my practice and people that are seeing a lot of women and treat women for fertility or in the perimenopause, menopause, you kind of have your five formulas that you kind of know you're going to go to, and then you would modify it a bit based on the individual. And what I see most common is what we call kind of the liver heart syndrome in Chinese medicine, that those organ systems, which are off. And so that's how we address it. In myself, anecdotally, clinically, the way I address it is if somebody's coming in and experiencing symptoms and they're perimenopause or menopause, I'm usually seeing them for acupuncture twice a week for about 4 weeks. And at the same time, they start their herbal formula. The goal is to the acupuncture to give them some symptom relief while their herbs are doing their thing. And then within that 4 week, I'm expecting change in symptoms. And then the acupuncture dosage can come back because they still have the herbal medicine they're doing. And then they're doing well. And then I reduce the acupuncture more. Maybe they're coming in twice a month for acupuncture, still on the herbal formula. And then eventually they're doing the acupuncture once a month and they're on the herbal formula. And I would expect somebody to be on that formula for about 6 months. And then we see how they're doing. And then we could start to pull back the formula a bit. And then they may go on and off it as needed. And so that'd be my approach. And, you know, people like, why or how could the acupuncture be working? From a West, there's a whole Chinese medicine thinking, but the Western paradigm, it's releasing, helping you release endorphins. It helps regulate the hypothalamus, pituitary, ovarian axis. So you're talking about the orchestra that lost the conductor. So if we're able to bring some balance back, usually the symptoms will shift. It's, you know, helps with that autonomic nervous system to get you out of sympathetic into parasympathetic. We didn't really talk about it today, but stress aggravates all your symptoms of diseases and symptoms of hormonal imbalances. And acupuncture helps with blood flow. It helps with regulating inflammation, helps with mitochondrial on a cellular level. And I think really when you're, if you're addressing the autonomic nervous system, if it's having a nervous system reset, if you're able to really go from high beta brainwaves to, you know, overwhelm to alpha, detached relaxation, or some sympathetic into parasympathetic, the body can heal. And so anything, so that's acupuncture. Look, if you do breathing and visualization and put your, like, it's not like anybody has an acupuncture deficiency, just like for patients that are depressed, they don't have a Prozac deficiency, right?
No, quite. Yeah.
Right. So there's many ways to engage the body's innate healing. And that's what the acupuncture is doing, which is why if it is able to create the rebalance and your body regains its harmony, when you stop the acupuncture, the symptoms are not supposed to come back because the body is now maintaining homeostasis. We're not overriding the body. We're supporting the body to regain its homeostasis. And then when it does, you're supposed to be able to pull back the acupuncture nerves.
This is really interesting because now I'm translating this to my Western medical thinking, medical approach. That, of course, women, of course, you're going to have it different symptoms, even if your hormone pattern is the same, because you've got different individual biological response to your hormones. You can have two women that exactly the same level of progesterone. One will say, I feel dreadful, I've got PMS, and the other one will say, I feel fine. So that explains we are individuals, by the way, not clones, and we have our own biological response. And the other really important point you make there, I think, is that there is this interaction with the conductor and the external world, or more precisely, how you process information. So the example I give is you can be sitting in a traffic jam and you almost have a choice how you respond to that. You can feel really stressed, get really annoyed, activate that fight or flight thing and get the cortisol up and work yourself into a real lover. Or you can say, look, this is really annoying. It's out of my control. I'm just going to accept it. I'm going to shut my eyes. I'm going to meditate. I'm going to listen to music. Well, actually, maybe don't meditate while you're trying to drive the car. But anyway, you know what I mean? You can, it's your choice how you respond to these things. And if
Okay.
you can, and we know that this has an effect on how the hormone system works. This is why cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, works for some women with FHA, functional hypothalamic amenorrhea. You've done everything. I've done everything with them. The nutrition, the exercise, I'm feeling pretty, they're doing everything. They've ticked all the boxes, yet why have their periods not started? And this is where acupuncture or CBT or something that is more like you say, just rejigging or whatever at that cerebral level almost, that's crucial. And there's, by the way, it's no coincidence that the conductor of the endocrine orchestra, the pituitary gland and the hypothalamus above it, is located deep in your brain, just where the optic nerves cross over. So it's the seat of processing all the information from the outside and how you interpret that, and then directing the appropriate response. So I think we've come full circle here.
And it was interesting how you said the hypothalamus, pituitary, you said the optic nerves is they're crossed
Yeah,
over in that
they're
area.
crossing over there, and it's just literally there, so it
So
can
yeah, and look what we're,
perfectly positioned.
yeah. So and so when you change, because I use this wording, so it fits perfectly for this. I say you experience the world through the lenses of your subconscious programming.
Well,
And
there
if
you
you
go.
want to have a different experience of reality, then you change the lens of your lens. So you change your programs, and then now you're going to perceive that same reality differently because the reality you experience is different than somebody else, even though you're both looking at the same reality based on the lens of your subconscious.
And also, this affects this, what we're talking about, how you perceive it or how you interpret or process. This also directly affects the hormone production
Yes.
incredibly. There's been a study by Mary Day D'Souza, I think she's in America anyway, and she found that, going back to the REDS thing, the relative energy deficiency in sport, she found that, and also I found this in another study of a PhD student I was supervising anyway, just the cognitive, the anxiety of feeling I ha should restrict what I eat, even if you don't follow through and restrict what you're eating, even if you're just thinking about it, the anxiety of it, that actually decreases the T3. Which is an indicator of energy availability. So there we go. We have definitely come, as I say, full circle,
Full
not only
circle.
how you process it, but how you process that information or interpret that, that actually we have proof directly can affect some of those hormone systems and not just the neurological system. So there we go.
As we wrap up, because you're also involved in the myths of menopause, is there anything you kind of want to share with our listener? Just certain myths that you have seen over the years, hence you're involved in the book, that can help these women advocate for themselves when they see their health provider and just also give them some comfort that they're not crazy.
First of all, I think one of the main myths that we've already discussed, and Geraldine, of course, wrote the chapter on that, is that estrogen is the T hormone, and that's the one that drops first. So it's not. We've sort of covered that progesterone story. But the main myth is really to reinforce what we've discussed just now, that lots of people or lots of women, it is a really confusing time. So number one, you're not going crazy. And it's very individual. So that's sort of the first thing. You know your body best. So don't question it. If you feel that something is off and something's going on and you're of that age, you're probably right. Because it's so variable, it's not helpful to do blood tests because people like certainty. I think this is the problem. This is the main myth. Everybody wants certainty, but perimenopause by definition is uncertain. So, doing a blood test won't necessarily help because you might catch it. The hormones in a good cycle or a bad cycle, but it doesn't really inform you what's going to happen next. And so that's the first myth. I'm afraid you have to kind of go with it. But the most important thing is also, like we discussed, that you do have agency. You do have control of the situation. Okay. And also, it's not an illness. It's not a disease. It is a natural physiological event, albeit challenging. The female hormone odyssey, this is a challenging time, but women I know are up for this challenge. So, take control, recognize it for what it is, take control of the situation. Look to those lifestyle and, those supplements that we've discussed. You can definitely make big improvements on that. And then, yes, I think you should consider, at least dis consider and have that discussion about HRT, because you can't really predict whether, because I have lots of, some women say, oh, I'm never going to touch that stuff. Or some say, oh, yeah, absolutely, I'm going to take it, So it is very polarized, the view. In my book, I describe it as Scylla and Charybdis, the two portrayed as two equally evil things. Somehow you have to navigate. There's one camp saying definitely take HRT straight away, and the others say no, don't take it at all. But I think you've just got to, you've got to make that informed decision for yourself. Having made all the lifestyle changes we've discussed, if you are still struggling, it is for quality of life. That's what it is. Then absolutely, I think it's totally reasonable to at least try. And also be discerning in your choice of HRT. Like you said, the molecular identical type of HRT is definitely the best one. So typically that is estrogen through the skin. I prefer the gel because it's more flexible in its dose and that bypasses the liver. So we don't have any problems inducing enzymes and whatever. And then the micronized progesterone we've mentioned as per Geraldine Pryor, that's really the best combination. But the guiding principle is always start low because the problem is sometimes, like you mentioned at the very beginning, women are prescribed or ask for very high dose of estrogen and the micronized progesterone, but actually that could even make it worse, like you've said, because it's not really a problem with the estrogen, frankly, initially. So that's the other thing to bear in mind. Make sure you're asking for the good stuff and that you are asking for the lowest possible dose of estrogen, and then the progesterone is the really good one. And then also be aware that it will take time to have effect. I have lovely women who take the HRT and then they send me an email a few days later, I don't feel any different. It does take time for the hormones, to smooth them out. So it will take time, and you might have to change the dose in the future. So that's the other myth, that there is only one type of HRT. You have to take the maximal dose. This is the dose. It's fixed. That's not the case. And also, how long should you take HRT for? It's like, how long is a bit of string? There is no absolute deadline. It used to be said, oh, you take it for 5 years and then you stop. But the British Menopause Society say that there is no arbitrary limit to how long you take it. So those are some things. And then the other thing, which is always an awkward point of discussion, that vaginal symptoms or the genital urinary system of the menopause, those symptoms can be awkward to discuss, but we will. vaginal dryness, urinary tract issues, wanting to go to the loo a lot, that's easily reversible or helps if with vaginal estrogen. And this is just absorbed locally. So you can take it in addition or stand alone to the systemic HRT we've been discussing. And there's a chapter in the book written by my colleague. It's the provocatively, I think the title is something like No Sex After Menopause, So don't worry, that's not the case. And she puts you right on that. So I think those are the main ones. And I think that the main point is lots of women feel like, oh, that's the end of my enjoyable life. It's sort of like a really bad thing to happen. But I think a more positive outlook and saying it's just part of this female hormone odyssey. And actually, it gives you an opportunity to maybe explore things that you haven't had time to or didn't think about before. And you want to make the most women, because of the increased life expectancy, we might, be lucky enough to expect to spend a third of our life in menopause. So it's not just, oh, I think, again, encouraging women to make the most out of all of their life, including this bit. There is definitely some positives to it, and it's a good opportunity to refresh and revise what you're doing to get the most out of your life.
I always enjoy our conversations. I want to refer to where people can find you and let them know that, again, we have a podcast, episode 91 with Dr. Nikki Kay, and that is titled The Female Hormone Odyssey. So I invite you to listen to that. Episode 89 with Dr. Geraldine Pryor, Decoding Hormone Balance, The Power of Progesterone, because we mentioned her. And we have a few other Peter Wright's on here and Lara Bryden, others that have talked about menopause and perimenopause to check out. And then Nikki's on Face. She's got a website. She's on Facebook. We'll put that in the show notes, but it's NikkiKFitness.com. And on Instagram, it's Dr. Nikki K. It's on Facebook, Nikki K Fitness. And she has, again, you can go to her website, NikkiKFitness.com, to find her books as well. So that's all in the show notes. Dr. Nikki, I really enjoyed our conversation again today. Thank you so much for making the time to discuss what's happening to a lot of these women over 40, and that there's hope and solutions so they can have, as you said, the later third of their life, they can be better than the first two
Yeah,
thirds.
they're pretty. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, thank you so
They can
much for
be.
inviting me to discuss. Always a great conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Just a wrap up. I really enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Nikki. I hope you enjoyed it as well. And I mentioned a few resources that I'll repeat on the AccuBalance.ca website. There are lots of blogs on menopause and perimenopause, so information for you there. We have a longevity diet, which is a anti-inflammatory, low glycemic index diet, which should be excellent for those wanting to balance their hormones. And then check out other episodes on the Conscious Fertility podcast. We have several related to the perimenopause and menopause topic, so hopefully you'll find that of interest. And then conscious work part, I see people besides fertility that want to work on their inner healer, I guess. And there's lots of information on the AccuBalance website regarding that if you're curious to know more about how to rewire or change outdated subconscious beliefs or limiting beliefs that are no longer serving you.
If you're looking for support to grow your family, contact AccuBalance Wellness Center. At AccuBalance, they help you reach your peak fertility potential through their integrative approach, using low-level laser therapy, fertility acupuncture, and naturopathic medicine. Download the AccuBalance Fertility Diet and Dr. Brown's video for mastering manifestation and clearing subconscious blocks. Go to AccuBalance.ca, that's ACUBalance.ca.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Conscious Fertility, the show that helps you receive life on purpose. Please take a moment to subscribe to the show and join the community of women and men on their path to peak fertility and choosing to live consciously on purpose. I would love to continue this conversation with you, so please direct message me on Instagram at Lauren Brown Official. That's Instagram, Lauren Brown Official. Or you can visit my websites, laurenbrown.com and accubalance.ca. Until the next episode, stay curious, and for a few moments, bring your awareness to your heart center and breathe.